We're going to talk today, as we have many, many times over the past 16 years, about addiction. And our guest today is Candace Plator, and her book is called Loving an Addict, Loving Yourself, the Top 10 Survival Tips for Loving Someone with an Addiction. Candace is a therapist in private practice in Vancouver, British Columbia. She specializes in addictive behaviors such as alcohol, drugs, eating, smoking, gambling, internet, overspending, and relationships. And she offers individual, couple, and family counseling in her office and by telephone worldwide. So it's our pleasure today to have Candace on the line to talk about her take on addiction. Hi, Candace.
Hello, Wynn. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
Everyone.
Okay, so why did you get into the field of addiction and helping people with addiction problems?
Well, that's a really good question. What happened for me is that back in the 70s, when I was in my early 20s, I was diagnosed with Crohn's disease, which, for people who don't know what that is, unfortunately more people know about it now than they did before, but it's an inflammatory bowel disease that's very painful. It can be quite debilitating for people. When I was diagnosed in the 70s, the doctors didn't really know what this illness was. It was quite new to them, and they didn't know what to do for me. So what they did was they gave me a whole lot of medications, and several of them were very addictive medications. They gave me Valium and codeine and Demerol, which would probably be equivalent to something like today's OxyContin. And they gave me those drugs. They prescribed them for years and years and years, week after week, month after month. So I took them as prescribed. I don't remember abusing them, quote unquote. I don't think I took more than, you know, I was supposed to, but my body became very addicted to them, as anybody's body would. And I also became incredibly depressed because those drugs are depressants in the system. So if you fast forward about 15 years, 1987, around there, I was so depressed that I was actually suicidal and I was considering taking my own life. I knew I had enough pills and I knew I could time it just right so that nobody would find me in time. And that really, really scared me. So I reached out for help. I got some very, very needed counseling. I started going to 12-step programs. I started going to Narcotics Anonymous, Alcoholics Anonymous, even though drinking was not, you know, drinking hurt my stomach, so I didn't do much of it. I started going to Adult Children of Alcoholics, ACOA, CODA, Codependence Anonymous, a lot of the 12-step programs that were available back then, and started my own journey of recovery. I consider myself to be an addict in recovery, and I today have 27 years clean and sober, and I'm a lot healthier now. I still have Crohn's. It's an incurable chronic illness, but I'm a lot better because I know how to take care of myself a lot more. I know what it's like to be an addict. I know what it's like to be the loved one of an addict. And I've been working as an addiction therapist for many years, for over 25 years now, giving back a lot of the help that I received when I needed it. And so today, I basically work with the loved ones of people with addiction because there's a lot of help out there for people who are addicts of any kind. There's more help for alcoholics and drug addicts than there are for any other kinds of addicts. But there's still places where people can go to get help for other addictions. But for the loved ones, who struggle and suffer right alongside the people that they love so much who are addicted, there's not very much help for them out there. There's Al-Anon. There's, you know, a smattering of treatment programs that have family programs, and I'm really glad that they do now, but there aren't too many places that have that. So I just felt like I needed to work with those people and help them learn the difference between the help that they wanted to give their addicts and the enabling that most of them were doing, which keeps the addiction going. So that's become my mission, is to help the loved ones of the people with addiction. Wow, that was a long answer.
Well, the loved ones really need the help. Of course, the addicts do too. And I think that addiction is the most serious health problem in the world because...
You know, I would agree with you. I think it is too.
Yeah, because it affects just about everybody, either personally or their family. And the problems that come up with a person with addiction may be different in every addiction, but there's still significant problems regardless of what type of addictive behavior you have.
That's right. That's right. And a lot of the problems are the same, too. Some of them are different. A lot of them are the same.
Well, now, your book is geared toward family addiction. How is it different from other works?
From other books that are similar to mine?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. I think the biggest difference is most people who write about addiction in the family are talking primarily about how to get help for the addict. They're talking about, you know, how to have an intervention, how to get an addict to go to treatment, those kinds of issues, which are all important. But they're not really addressing the loved ones. They're not really talking about how the loved ones can change what they're doing to contribute something different to the situation. What I like to tell loved ones is that they are not responsible for the addict's addiction. They did not cause the addict's addiction. They're not making the addict's choices for them. But they are responsible for how they may be contributing to the addiction continuing with some of the enabling behaviors that they're doing. All we can change is ourselves. We can't change anybody else. We can't make an addict go to treatment kind of thing. But loved ones can change what they've been doing to make it healthier, to make it more uncomfortable for the addict to remain in active addiction and help them get into active recovery. And so that's what my book is about, what the loved ones can actually do.
Well, you brought up...
And what,
yeah.
I was just going to say, and what they shouldn't do.
Okay. You brought up the term enabling, and most people that are listening don't know what that means. Could you contrast helping behavior and enabling behavior?
I can, yes. You know, an enabling behavior would be something like giving money to an addict, paying a person's rent. If the addict you love is an overspender and goes out and spends their whole paycheck in the mall and then can't afford rent, or maybe has gambled all their money away and can't afford rent or food, and you rescue them, you come to their rescue and you give them money for this, that's an enabling behavior, because we all know that if you do that, they have no real reason to change what they're doing. So something that I see a lot is parents of adult children who are addicted, who, you know, the parents allow the adult children to live at home, in the family home, without contributing any rent, any money to food or electricity, or, you know, they have a cushy bed, they have a nice shower, they have food in the fridge that they can eat, they can be as abusive and obnoxious as they want to. When they hear the word no, they punch holes in the walls. Things like that happen, and the parents don't know how to stop that. So they allow that to continue. It can be a very scary situation. Addicts can get pretty angry. So I understand that if they do that, if they don't stop that, why should the addict do anything different? So enabling is that kind of behavior that doesn't help the addict. So a helping behavior might be something where you say to the person that you love, and you would do this in a non-charged moment, not when they're high or drunk or, you know, but you would say to the person, you know, I love you so much. I love you so much that it's just tearing me up inside to watch what you're doing to yourself, to watch you sabotage your life. I don't want to do this anymore, and I understand now that this isn't helpful for you. So I love you enough to stop doing this. I love you so much that I am no longer willing to support you in your act of addiction. So when you're ready to get some recovery and go into active recovery, let me know and I will help you then. But I'm no longer willing to do this for you anymore. That's a helping behavior.
That's what some people call tough love.
Yes, it is tough love. And tough love is love. The most loving thing we can do for people who are in active addiction is to make it as uncomfortable as possible for them to stay in active addiction. How is it loving to rescue and enable an addict so that they can stay in the addiction? How is that a loving act?
Right. If you do that, they don't have a reason to want to change.
That's right. Consequences have to be there in order for, you know, when I was in my addiction, I didn't have the same kind of enabling that I'm talking about. My family didn't really do that with me. They basically just cut me off. It wasn't a lot of love, tough love or love. I think to myself sometimes, if I had been enabled that way, if they had paid my rent, if they had done that for me, would I have stopped? Probably not. And it may have killed me. And, you know, the most loving thing we can do is to have behaviors that actually help a person stop the addiction. I believe that addiction, in order to stop addiction, we need to stop the enabling first. And when that happens, it's just astonishing. I watch it all the time. When the enabling stops, the addict sits up and takes notice and says, uh-oh, you know, maybe I better do something different.
Right, right. Well, now, it seems to me that a lot of the enablers are also addicted. They're codependents, and they have that going on in their backyard.
Yeah, and I'm really glad that you brought that up, and that might be another word that listeners might not be too familiar with. So my definition of codependency, it's a buzzword, and people hear it, but they don't quite know what it means. And what I think is that it's when we put others' needs ahead of our own on a fairly consistent basis, that's being codependent. I kind of think that people-pleasing and codependency are basically the same thing, and I use those terms interchangeably. I also see codependency as something that isn't loving toward the person that you're doing it with. I think that codependence, and I will say that I am a recovering codependent. I don't do it very much anymore. But when we are codependent, we're actually meeting our own needs and not the needs of the addict. Because when we're people-pleasing, what we're trying to do at all costs is avoid conflict. Codependent people hate conflict. It scares them. They don't know how to handle it. So instead of doing something healthy, they will say, oh, okay, I'll let you do that. And so they're really meeting their own needs and not meeting the need of the addict, because what the addict needs is to be stopped.
Right. Okay, so in your opinion, How do people get addicted in the first place, and how do you define addiction?
Well, I define addiction, that's a really good question, as a symptom, basically. I think it's really just a symptom of what's underneath it. And in order for people to stop doing whatever it is they're doing to make themselves feel better, I mean, addiction is kind of a thwarted version of self-care, where we're using addictions in order to feel better, but, you know, it always comes back to bite us, so it's not a very good way to feel better. But what's underlying the addiction, the issues, the unhappiness, the lack of self-respect, the, you know, all of the things that we feel when we're pumping things into our system, poison that we shouldn't be putting in, or engaging in behaviors like gambling or, you know, whatever we're doing to hurt our lives and to hurt ourselves, we need to find out why we're shooting ourselves in the foot to begin with in order to be able to stop doing that. So I think people become addicted because they're not happy. They find a behavior or a substance that helps them feel good. And most people who become addicted think to themselves, well, you know, it's not going to happen to me. I'm not going to get addicted. You might get addicted, but I'm not going to get addicted. And then they get addicted. They don't set out to become addicts. Nobody sets out to become an addict. But when you make the choice to use over and over and over again, you're going to get addicted. Anybody's going to get addicted. That's how the substance is in the body. That's how the behavior works.
Candace, would you like for me to tell you what my definition of addiction is?
Sure.
I believe that if someone discovers a behavior that they have is hurting themselves or someone that they love, and they can't stop it for whatever reason, they're addicted. How do you think about that?
Well, I agree. I think that, but I have a different point of view as well, because I think people can stop. You said something about you can't stop it. I would just change that to say it's very difficult to stop it, because anybody can stop an addiction. And if that weren't true, we wouldn't have people recovering all over the world. I wouldn't be in recovery now if it wasn't possible to recover. It's a choice we make. We don't make the choice to become addicted. We're not out there trying to become an addict. But when we're in active addiction, we have a choice. We can either stay in active addiction, or we can reach out for some help and go into active recovery.
Now, when you talk about it, go ahead.
I see addiction as a choice more than anything else. Whether it's a disease, whether there's a genetic predisposition, whether we've learned it at home because our parents were doing it, all of that is important, but it really doesn't matter, because ultimately, no matter what else addiction is, it's a choice.
Now, you talked about being in recovery, and that sounds like 12-step talk. 12-steppers don't believe that you can be cured. They believe that you can only stay away from the thing that you're wanting to stay away from if you follow their program. Do you believe that there's a cure for addiction?
You know, I'm not sure. I don't really know that. I'm not a medical person, and I don't really know if there's a cure. I don't usually use that language. What I do for myself, the choice I make every day, is to not pick up a drug or a drink, to not engage in addictive behaviors. I make that choice every day, and that keeps me clean and sober, and it's kept me clean and sober for the last 27 years, you know, because I make that choice. Whether something really hard is going on in my life or whether I break my shoelace, I make the choice about whether, you know, about how I'm going to deal with that. So I think that if we've been addicted at some point, as I have been, that we need to be vigilant. We need to be careful. I think abstinence is a really good thing. But I also know of some people who have been addicted and who seem to be able to control what they're doing, at least for a while. And some of them are able to have that glass of wine at dinner for, you know, once or twice a week. And they seem to be okay with that. So I don't know whether there's a cure. I think it's a one day at a time thing. And when I talk about recovery, I'm not a proponent or an opponent of 12-step programs. I know that they don't work for everybody. I know that there are now some alternatives that weren't there when I first cleaned up. And whatever works for a person to make their life better, to get out of addiction, I think is great.
Okay, so I believe that the underlying cause of all addictive behaviors is low self-esteem. And I believe people with low self-esteem go out into society and try to find things that are common and available that will make them feel better about themselves. And that the answer to addiction is to do something so that that person really increases their self-esteem so they don't need addictive behaviors. Would you agree, disagree, or?
I think that you're absolutely right in that when a person starts and is, you know, experimenting with drugs and alcohol or other addictive behaviors, that they're generally not feeling very good about themselves or they wouldn't have to do that. I think that there's a difference between self-esteem and self-respect. It's a kind of a difficult one to define, but I'm going to try. For me, self-esteem has to do with being able to, knowing that I do a good job at work, being able to raise a family that's healthy, you know, being out there in the world and doing okay means that I have self-esteem. I feel good about that. Of course, the opposite is true. If you're not able to hold a job or your family is in disarray, then you're not going to feel good about yourself and you're not going to have a lot of self-esteem. Self-respect is how you feel about yourself at 3 o'clock in the morning when you're still lying in bed and you're worrying about things and you just don't feel good about yourself. Maybe other people don't see that part of you, but you know it's there. And so I think that self-esteem and self-respect go hand in hand. And when we're using addictive behaviors of any kind, we don't have our self-respect. And I believe that self-respect is pretty much the most important thing we either have or don't have. And you can't go buy it at 7-Eleven. You know, I can't give you yours. You can't give me mine. It's an inside job. We have to develop this ourselves by doing the next right thing and the next right thing after that, building up the self-trust. So that would be my answer to that question.
Well, we've gone through the majority of the program. We're down to a little under 3 minutes, and unfortunately, we haven't told the people about the top 10 survival tips. And I know that you can't get into them, but that's what your book's about.
And yes, my book is about the top 10 survival tips for loving someone with an addiction, and it's called Loving an Addict, Loving Yourself, because we can love addicts, but we need to love ourselves. We need to love ourselves, and we need to take care of ourselves. Many loved ones are addicted to the addict's addiction. If the addict's doing okay, they're doing okay. If the addict isn't doing okay, they're not doing okay. And that needs to stop, and loved ones need to start taking care of themselves, live their own best lives, and that's what this book is about, how to do that.
Right, and I found it very instructive, and if you have a addict in the family, you really need to get this book because it's going to help you a lot. Where can they get a copy, Candace?
Well, you can get a PDF version that you can read on your computer on my website if you want to do that. You can also get the hard copy. It's not in hardcover. It's a soft cover book, but you can get the actual book itself at Amazon. You can get it at Chapters online, Barnes & Noble online. A lot of bookstores have it now, so if your bookstore doesn't have it, ask them to order it. It's quite easy for them to get.
Would you give us your website address?
Sure. It's www.candaceplatter.com. So that is spelled C-A-N-D-A-C-E. P as in Peter, L-A-T-T-O-R.
Okay. And
I also have a Facebook page for loved ones, and it's called Loving an Addict, Loving Yourself. So I'm hoping that if loved ones are listening today that you'll come and check out my Facebook page. It's got some really wonderful things. There's a great community being formed there.
Great. Well, we're out of time, but let me ask you quickly. Do you take telephone calls and counsel people that are quite a distance away from you?
I do. I have clients in Australia and Hong Kong and England and various places in the United States and Canada. Yep.
Okay.
But I do work primarily with the loved ones now. I will work with the addicts if they're part of the family, but I'd rather work with the loved ones first.
Okay.
And get that under control.
We're talking to Candace Plater. We're out of time. Loving an addict, loving yourself. Thank you so much for being on the show today.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.